7.
Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to try to explain why these things are happening. And this morning our attention is going to return to the world of Islam, this time Egypt. Then during the second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms. In fact, we're going to continue to learn His terms so that we can benefit from His Torah, which means teaching, not law. If you are rational, if you have an open mind, this will be the best part of today's program. Our phone number, if you would like to direct the conversation, if you would like to engage in our conversation, it is 877-300-7645. This story was from WorldNet Daily. There's actually two on the same topic. They are related, but don't necessarily overlap. WorldNet Daily, Pat Farah is the founder. I think you'd have to say they are well on the conservative side, more intellectual than any of the mainstream media, typically more accurate than the mainstream media. I think overall their writers are hugely better informed, whether they're, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 30 times, hard to put a finger on it, but their writers are vastly better informed than are the English majors who come out of the top liberal arts schools to write for major periodicals. But does not mean that they're entirely right. There's errors that permeate even their work. Both of these stories are from WorldNet Daily. This begins the Arab Spring, and as we have already discussed on this program, there is no such thing as an Arab Spring. This has been an Islamic Reformation. That is a very bad thing, because as I shared with you yesterday, if Islam is reformed, then it becomes more fundamentalist. A reformation is to reform something on its base. If you bring Islam back to its roots, if Islam becomes more like Muhammad's life, Muhammad's existence, like the lives of the first Muslims, it becomes hell. You know, it's not a case like Christianity, where the Messiah Yahusha, the real name of Jesus Christ, the Messiah Yahusha, if Christians reformed their lives by following his example, they'd be Torah observant. They'd all engage in the covenant. This world would be heaven on earth. Now, there isn't a Christian in the world that follows Yahusha's example. Not one. They don't even listen to what he has to say. Christianity is actually predicated on the writings of Paul, who was a false prophet. But in the case of Islam, since Muhammad was a rapist, he was a pedophile, he was incestuous, he was a sexual pervert, he was a slave trader, he was a kidnapper, he was an avowed liar, he was a thief, he was sadistic, he was a mass murderer, and he was a ruthless terrorist.
A general guy you'd like to follow?
Yeah, you know, if your goal is hell, if that's where you want to go, he's the right guy to follow. You know, it's interesting. The Quran is just filled with all sorts of vivid depictions of hell, and it always has Allah there in hell, perpetrating the tortures on the men. And it's pretty obvious that old Muhammad and Allah know a lot about the place, at least the place as they describe it. So the problem with what is actually happening, it is an Islamic Reformation. And the more you know about Islam, the more awful that is. The more rotten you know that is, the more corrupting it is. And so what is called an Arab Spring has been an Islamic Reformation, where in every country where there has been a revolution, two-thirds of the votes have been cast in favor of the fundamentalist Islamic candidates, and secular governments are now Islamic governments. And this even happened in Afghanistan, where we deposed a religious government, but the government we put in place started off as quasi-secular. It isn't anymore. You know, it's governed by Sharia law. It's now the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. In Iraq, it was a secular government before we invaded. It isn't anymore. The government of Iraq is controlled entirely by the mullahs in Tehran. Syria, right now, is a secular government. It won't be if the revolution that is being fueled by the United States and Saudi Arabia and others prevails. It'll be a religious government. In Tunisia, the first where this alleged Arab Spring took place, it wasn't a Islamic government, but it is now. Two-thirds of the votes were in favor of the Islamic Ennahda party. In Libya, it was not an Islamic government. It is now. In Egypt, the government was secular. It isn't anymore. And so across the board, every place that Muslims have the opportunity to vote, even in Turkey, which was the closest things that Islam has to a actual functioning country, Turkey has marched directly towards fundamentalist Islam in the last decade and is now as fundamentalist as are many of its neighbors. And so what is an Islamic Reformation, which is the single worst thing that could happen to planet Earth, once you have fundamentalist Muslims at the controls of these countries, the Magog War, which is the war predicted in Yah's Torah, Prophet, and Psalms, is inevitable. The Magog War is an all-Islamic war against Israel that then erupts, and in the rest of the world is embroiled in it. The first phase of it, one out of four people die. In the second phase, a third of those remaining die. And so this is a very big deal that most people just kind of overlook because it's over there. And the United States is now getting involved where it ought not be, once again, by taking sides militarily and in terms of espionage on behalf of the Mujahideen, the fundamentalist Islamic terrorists that are revolting against Assad, who is backed by Shia Islamic terrorists. There is no good side here. There is no prevailing. There's only losing. Well, this reads, the Arab Spring takeover of Egypt by the Muslim Brotherhood. And, you know, while the Muslim Brotherhood did win the majority of the votes, half as many votes as they received, a little more than that, than half their number of votes, the second largest group of votes went to the Salaf party. Now, most people haven't a clue what Salaf means, and yet it's as important a term as there is in terms of understanding the world as it is. Salaf speaks of fundamentalist Muslims. Salaf in Arabic is ancestor. And so what, by being a Salaf, what you're saying is that as a Muslim, you get your guidance from Muhammad, the founder of Islam, and from Muhammad's companions, who were the original ancestors. And therefore, you're getting your guidance about Islam from the Hadith and the Quran, which is a form of Hadith. Muslims will protest and say that isn't true, but the facts are it's undeniable. The Quran and Hadith came from the same person. They were passed on orally exactly the same way. And so by being a Salaf, you are a Muslim who is a fundamentalist. And the Salaf Party and the Muslim Brotherhood collectively won 75% of the seats for the Islamic Parliament in Egypt, a parliament which has been dissolved, but now has a new dictator, Mohamed Morsi. Anyway, this article reads, the Arab Spring lie, takeover of Egypt by the Muslim Brotherhood in conjunction with the Salaf Party, has run amok. No, it hasn't. It's doing exactly what they intended for it to do. With reports from several different media agencies that radical Muslims, oh, what a terrible lie. You know, it's just amazing to me. And this is I began this segment telling you that WorldNet Daily is far better informed than our most media outlets. This term, radical Muslim, it has been used so that people can write about Islam without running afoul of political correctness. And so the bad, the terrorist Muslims are radical Muslims, and the good, peaceful Muslims are just normal Muslims. Well, the opposite is true. Literally, the opposite is true. The terrorists are all just ordinary Muslims. All the really good Muslims are terrorists. You cannot be a good Muslim and not be a terrorist according to the Quran, particularly according to the last two surahs handed down, the ninth and the fifth, that would also be reinforced by the eighth. Impossible to be a peaceful person, to be a good person, and to be a Muslim according to the Quran's definition. And so the Muslims that are acting badly, that are terrorists, they're all good Muslims. They are fundamentalists. They're the opposite of a radical. Those who are radical Muslims are those who have corrupted their religion, who haven't really got a clue what Islam is, but, you know, they go through the motions because they go along to get along. And so the term is used so that a media outlet like this doesn't run afoul of political correctness, but it is insanely beguiling. Anyway, it says that several different media agencies are inferring that radical Muslims have begun crucifying opponents of the newly installed President Mohamed Morsi. Yes, you heard that correctly. Crucifying. Last week in Egypt, when the Muslim Brotherhood supporters terrorized the secular media, several Arabic websites, including Arab News, Al-Khabar News, Nordster Wantani, and Egypt Now, reported that people were being crucified. The relevant excerpt follows. But before I share that, one of the news agencies, the second one there, was listed. Al-Khabar. Al means the. Khabar is the name of a town. Why do you care? Why would I care? Why would I even bother to bring it up? Why are we spending, you know, this time talking about stuff that's happening half a world away? Because this stuff that is happening half a world away is going to devastate the world. Within the next 15 years, half the people on this planet are going to die because of their ignorance of what's happening half a world away. Because what's happening half a world away is going to be brought to your door. And there are very few things more important than understanding Khabar. After the break, we will return to Khabar and then to crucifixion, Islamic style. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Myths. You know, during the break, Scott and I were talking, and I'm going to get to Khabar, and I think I have more to say about Khabar than I'm going to be able to do in this, which is a short segment of the news. And what I was sharing with Scott is that yes, you know, we've focused a lot on Islam, and yet we have talked about the improper nature of militarism, particularly United States militarism, and how that relates to patriotism, and why you ought not be patriotic and you ought not be supportive of your military. And we will continue to do that. I will give you many, many reasons as to why that is inappropriate. And I know that's very unpopular, but it is a myth that is essential for us to shatter. I want you to at least know the truth, and then what you decide to do relative to it is up to you. I'm going to share with you why politics is not something you should engage in. Why, and we've done that in prior shows. We've talked about why, particularly in America, Democrats and Republicans, it makes no difference who you vote for. And matter of fact, if you are a conservative, you're better off with the liberals. And if you're liberal, you're better off with the conservatives because both parties are purely hypocritical. They do the opposite of what they say. And we will continue to talk about religions other than Islam. We dedicated one whole program to the Sheikh religion and the whole notion of God being created in the image of a man. We have devoted entire programs to Pauline doctrine and refuting the myths that are Christianity. We've spoken of Mormonism. And so we will continue to do that. But we will spend more time on Islam than we will others because it really involves all of this. It's so much economics involved here. There's so much politics involved here. There is so much religion involved here. There's so much militarism involved here. It is the omnibusman for all things wrong in the world. But beyond that, there are very few people who've come to understand Islam. Very few. I mean, there are Muslim imams who will advocate on behalf of Islam, but they are beguiled by this religion. In terms of actually understanding Islam, there may be 5 to 10 people on our planet at this time that understand the religion as well as I do. And of those, there's probably half of them that are willing to be as blunt and as bold about it and who have the opportunity to speak to you, at least for the time being, have the opportunity to speak bluntly and boldly to you about the religion of Islam. And so when you put those things together and you realize what the consequence of the world collectively embracing Islam and others ignoring Islam is, that half the people on this planet are going to be dead within the next 15 years because of our ignorance of this religion, our acceptance of this religion. The consequences are extremely high. This isn't just over there. They're going to destroy America's cities, Muslims. They're going to do everything they can collectively destroy Israel, and you ought to care about that. They are going to continue to kill one another, and while you may not care about that, because the United States and Western Europe and other countries are dependent upon oil, it's going to have devastating consequences. And ultimately, the world responds badly when it gets wrapped up into politics and patriotism and militarism. And as such, just as has happened in the past, everyone will rise up and want to declare war. And this time, because the weapons are so much more powerful, a world war this time will kill far more people than can even be imagined. So this is important. It's going to significantly affect everyone who is listening to this program, no matter where in the world you live. And so the more you know, the better able you are going to be able to protect your family. The more you know, the better position you are in to join the chorus of those with the compassion and the courage, the good sense to expose and condemn this awful religion. So now on to Kabar, and we'll complete our thoughts on Kabar after the break. When you hear Al-Kabar, which is one of the news agencies, you should scream. It should cause your blood to boil. If hearing Kabar doesn't cause you to scream, to have your blood boil, then it's only because you are ignorant of something that is very important for you to know. And ignorance, my friends, is not bliss. Let me tell you what happened in Kabar. Muhammad, after the satanic verses, was forced out of Mecca and had to go and seek solace for his pathetic new religion in Yathrib, today's Medina. On the way, he met with 12 Arabs in Yathrib who pledged to wage war against all humankind based upon Muhammad's promises. This is an important story. We will return to it after the break. I am Yatta. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Myths. I am your host, Yatta. If you wish to call during this program, it's 877-300-7645. We were talking about Kabar and why one should know about Kabar. And what I was sharing is that when Muhammad was booted out of Mecca in shame following the satanic verses where he claimed that he and all of Allah's witnesses were inspired by Satan, and where Muhammad added three cute little goddesses, kind of like the charities, which we'll return to in in our second half of our program. Three cute little goddesses, like the Christian charities, were also intermediaries to God, just like the Gospel of Grace. A very similar concept to the Gospel of Grace, actually. Anyway, he was booted out of Mecca and Shame. He went to Yathrib. On the way to Yathrib, he met with 12 Arabs from Yathrib who, in the Pledge of Aqaba, pledged to wage war against all humankind on behalf of Muhammad, and thus it begins the Islamic era. That's year one of the Islamic era. Muhammad goes into Yathrib and begins to be an anti-Semite. The second surah is the first surah revealed in Medina. It's anti-Semitic. Muhammad then buys Talmud readings from the Jews there. Then he butchers them and bastardizes them to serve his own agenda. The Jews laugh at him, and they and Muhammad borrows money from them because he doesn't work. None of his followers work, and they charge a modicum of interest. Then Muhammad has a tizzy fit over interest, has a tizzy fit that he doesn't want to pay them. The Jews say, hey, listen, we're just going to expose you. All you're doing is with your Quran is you're taking our stories, which you're paying us for, out of the Talmud, and you're twisting them to serve your interest. We're going to expose you as a fraud. And so Muhammad did what all egomaniacs do when in that position. He said, what if I just either exile or kill those who hold the goods on me? And so the first tribe, there were three large tribes of Jews in Yathrib. The first of those he exiled. They exiled to Kabar, which is why we're talking about this. The next two tribes, he killed the men, raped the women, enslaved the children, and stole their property. The stories of those other two tribes are told both in the Quran and Hadith, where it has Muhammad's pretend wannabe God terrorizing them, affirming that the women were raped, the children were sold into slavery, and that the men were murdered by the first Muslims. Well, what happened in Kabar? You see, the first tribe of Jews in Yathrib, today's Medina, were exiled as opposed to being murdered. They went to a neighboring community, reestablished themselves. They created a farming community in Kabar. Muhammad, one day, went down and said, you know, it's time that I should conquer Mecca. And he went down to conquer Mecca, but he got cold feet. Insufficient troops, I suppose. You can't call them troops. They were the same as today's Islamic mujahideen and jihadists. But insufficient men under arms to tackle Mecca, which, by the way, was nothing. Mecca didn't have an army, didn't have a police force. It was just a bunch of overindulgent businessmen living in mud huts. Wasn't very formidable. Had no walls to breach or anything like that. But Muhammad got cold feet. And so rather than fight the battle, he called the Meccans out and said, let's create a treaty. And it was the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. Muhammad denounced that he was a prophet of Allah. He then said that he would no longer terrorize the Meccans, wouldn't wage war against them for 10 years, wouldn't rob them, terrorize them, kidnap them, or rape them. That was pretty noble of him, you know, because he was really good at all of those things. And so the following year, Muhammad comes down with more men under arms, 10,000 this time, and he promptly conquers the place. And the ninth surah says that any agreement between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. Very insightful. But in between those two times, here Muhammad had a bunch of thugs. He was coming down to conquer Mecca. There were going to be lots of spoils for his mujahideen, for his jihadists. And he gets cold feet. He renounces his God, and they head on home. That would be like a Genghis Khan going out on a barbarian raid and telling his barbarians, hey, this time there's no loot. We're just going back home. I decided I don't want to fight today. They would all turn on him. And Muhammad knew it. So what Muhammad did is he went to the place that was the easiest patsy, where the prey was the most vulnerable. He went to the people that he had already kicked out of Yathrib, who had created a farming community in Kabar. It is where the Islamic prayer of fear was first uttered, Allahu Akbar. It was stated at the Jews. It means that Allah is greater than Yahweh. It is Satan's primary desire to be seen as greater than God, whose name is Yahweh. Allahu Akbar. Allah is the greatest. Allah is greater than Yahweh. And then as the Jewish men and women came out with their farm implements to tend their fields, there they were, the Muslims yelling, Allahu Akbar, armed to the teeth, facing off against them, and all hell broke loose. Muhammad savaged the community. He killed every man. They were all unarmed. He killed every man. He got the first pick of women to rape. He detailed his rape in graphic presentation of his rape of the prettiest woman. Talks about the rest of the women being raped by his mujahideen. And then the children were enslaved. All the property was confiscated. That is Kabar. And so when an Islamic news agency calls itself Kabar, and they look at it with pride, when Hamas calls their rockets the Kabar 1 and the Kabar 2, and the West yawns as if, oh, what does that mean to me? If you do not know the story of Kabar, of the men who were murdered there, of the women who were raped there, of the children who were enslaved there, of that being the place where the Islamic prayer of fear, Allahu Akbar, that was shouted as 19 Muslims flew planes into our buildings, killing 3,000 on 9/11. And every Islamic terrorist today shouts Allahu Akbar, which began at Kabar. If you don't know the story of Kabar, then you don't know the world as it is. Then you are easy to beguile. It's important that we know the truth. Because once you know the truth, once you understand what this religion is all about, once you know about Muhammad and understand Islam's submission, you're in a position to not only protect yourself and your loved ones, but also to do the right thing, to expose and condemn this awful religion, and to expose and condemn those who speak on behalf of this religion, as did George W. Bush, as does Barack Hussein Obama. When Americans go over and are committed to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, and yet Americans say we're not at war with Islam, Islam is a wonderful and great religion, we're at war with Al-Qaeda, and Americans die and people in those countries die at even a faster rate, you'll understand why it was wrong that we went there. Why we made a bad situation worse. Why you should not support your country and your military and your politicians when they act in such a horrible way. Moving on. Here is the relevant translation regarding crucifixion. A Sky News Arabic correspondent in Cairo confirmed that the protesters belonging to the Muslim Brotherhood crucified those opposing Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. They crucified them naked on trees in front of the presidential palace while they abused others. Likewise, Muslim Brotherhood supporters locked the doors of the media production facilities of 6 October, a major media region in Cairo, where they proceeded to attack several popular journalists. Now, you might say, crucify? Wow. I thought the last crucifixions were the Romans. No, not actually. Even the Japanese crucified Christians. The last of those were in Nagasaki. Crucifixion still exists. It is actually not only condoned in the Quran, it is ordered in the Quran. If you are a good Muslim, you are ordered by your God to crucify those who are opposed to Muhammad and Allah. Those who try to expose and condemn the religion of Islam, as I'm doing here, good Muslims are ordered to crucify. And not just crucify. In addition to crucify, cut off an arm and a leg on opposite sides. It's Quran 5:33. What's interesting here is that I wrote a book 10 years ago now, in the fall of 2001, immediately after 9/11, after I met with Al-Qaeda personally. I wrote a book called Tea with Terrorists. And I wrote it in the form of a novel because I thought that it was a higher likelihood that Americans could be enticed to read a novel, and that through that novel I could present the future that was awaiting America and the West. Through that novel I could explain what course we could chart if we wanted to end Islamic terrorism, the threat of Islamic terrorism in 90 days, and gave a three-point plan for doing so. But in the form of a novel, I could get people's attention and share information with them that was vital for them to know in a more palatable way, because most people prefer novels to nonfiction. Well, why would I bring this up, Tea with Terrorists, at this time? Well, the crux, the center act of Tea with Terrorists is crucifixions. I had the Muslims in Afghanistan crucify those who went in to stop their terrorist plans. And I used crucifixion not only because I knew that it was essential to Islamic theology. It's in the fifth surah. The fifth surah is the last handed down, can't be abrogated. 533 speaks of crucifying those who oppose Islam. And so not only did I know that it was decreed by Islam, but if presenting something that savage, that graphic, was enough to really get people's attention, where they say, all right, in a personal way, I now get it. I now understand this. You know, if you speak of an entire city being devastated, if you speak even of 3,000 people being killed on 9/11, we really don't relate to that. There's something about the human psyche that when I tell you about the one little girl whose fingernails were pulled out because she wouldn't agree to prostitute herself as a 13-year-old for her, on behalf of her Islamic husband, that grips us. It gets our attention. And I use crucifixion the same way in Tea with Terrorists. And now it is being perpetrated in the capital of Egypt. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll return to this story after the break. 877-300-7645. Segment of the news hour of Shattering Myths. One thing here we return back to the article. We were talking about crucifixion, and that was the pivotal term of Tea with Terrorists. So much of Tea with Terrorists turned out to be prophetic. Not prophetic because I'm claimed to be a prophet. I don't. And I want to make that very clear. I do not claim to be a prophet. But most of what I wrote in Tea with Terrorists either has occurred or is in the is commencing, and at this very time, crucifixion now happens to be another of those things that I predicted that is actually occurring. The only reason I was able to predict the future in Tea with Terrorists is because I read the playbook. I read first Yah's prophetic declaration, so I knew what he said was going to happen. But also I studied Islam, and when you study Islam, you come to understand it. When you come to understand it, it's easy to predict people's behavior and what's going to happen in the world. One of the things that I mentioned tangentially as I was telling the story of Kabar was the story of Hudabaya and how Hudabaya played into Kabar, because Muhammad took his goons down to Mecca, but he thought that he had insufficient men under arms to conquer the place, because the last two times the Meccans and he and his goons had confronted each other, he got his behind absolutely kicked, lost teeth, nearly killed, had to scurry away with his tail between his legs in the second of the three skirmishes they fought together. And in the third, he hunkered on down inside behind the earthworks of Yathrib. And the Meccans, because they didn't have an army, they had no siege equipment, a bunch of overweight businessmen, failed in their attack of Yathrib. But he was still hiding inside and living in fear. He was afraid of these guys. The mud hut village of Mecca scared him to death, and that's the reason why he signed this peace treaty. Now, this peace treaty, though, is really important. If you're dealing with your government, and you see, you know, your government's trying to negotiate now with the Taliban. Your government is trying to negotiate with Iran as it relates to its nuclear weapons. The government is trying to negotiate with Syria. Well, the government is involved in negotiations with Pakistan. When you recognize the nature of the Treaty of Hudaybiyah and how it is presented later than in the ninth surah of the Quran, you recognize that that is stupid. That means that those acting on behalf of your government are ignorant and irrational. And you don't want that. That's a bad thing. And the reason they're ignorant and irrational is because Muhammad's treaty with the Meccans and Hudaybiyah was that he would not wage war against them, he would not fight them, he would not kidnap them, he would not rob them, he would not terrorize them for 10 years. The following year, he came down and did all of those things. And so the Quran says in the ninth surah, it opens with any agreement, any treaty, any agreement between a Muslim and a non-Muslim is not binding on the Muslim. And so what good does it do? So in the West Bank, you get the Muslims to say, hey, we'll recognize Israel's rights to exist. We won't seek to destroy Israel anymore if you declare that this land, which is really theirs, is now ours. Well, if you understand the Treaty of Hudaybiyah and the Quran's support of that treaty and breaking it, you would never go there. You would realize that's stupid, and that's yet what your government, both Republicans and Democrats, are pursuing. If you don't understand the Treaty of Hudaybiyah, you're not in a position to know what it is that your government and military is doing that is actually counterproductive. A complete waste of time. Now let's return to this article, and we'll cover it again tomorrow. It says that the Sky News correspondents confirmed that crucifixion was being used in addition to terrorist tactics related to journalists, that there were attacks and violence in front of Egypt's presidential palace, and that major media facilities, as has been well documented, were sieged and the journalists themselves abused. Last Wednesday, August 8th, thousands of the Muslim Brotherhood supporters attacked the media facilities. They beat Khalid Shalah, chief editor of the privately owned and secular Yom 7 newspaper, prevented Yusuf al-Hassani, a on-air TV broadcaster, from entering the building and, quote, terrorized all of the employees. El-Balad adds that the supporters of Taflik Osaka, another vocal critic of President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, he too was attacked while the attackers screamed, Allahu Akbar. We'll return to this story in our program tomorrow, but after the break, we're going to turn to the terms of Yahweh, our God.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joel Wallach, the Dead Doctors Don't Lie guy. There's no reason why you shouldn't live to be at least 100 and have a great time getting there. And I'm going to give you a